thought it best to try to live life, persevere, not look back. Now that she wasn't bewildered and furious, she just continued to express her grief in private, sobbing while no one else looked. But someone was looking, quietly paying attention. After gymnastics practice that day, she approached Jackie in the parking lot. Jackie knew the bubbly blonde woman whose daughter went to gymnastics with Stephanie. "Hi, Terrell," said Jackie. "Jackie, I'm so sorry." Terrell had come a long way. She was Terrell Warner now, married, with kids, and a track record for taking on tough cases as a victim's advocate. In this casual exchange with Jackie, she was on the cusp of taking on a case that would test her willingness to push through obstacles, setbacks, authority figures. After she graduated from USC, Terrell was in an LDS church group in Irvine when she met April, a gorgeous, charismatic woman, tall and slender with long brunette hair. The pair started chatting. Within days, even within hours, something clicked. April was a recent graduate of BYU who modeled for a local diet center where she worked. Terrell felt very comfortable with April, so much so that Terrell felt she had a best friend for the first time in her life. But something was bothering April, too. She was tired, had dark circles under her eyes. In September, April called Terrell. "Something's wrong with my blood." Within days, April was admitted to the hospital with leukemia. Terrell dropped out of the Bank of America management training program so she could spend time at the hospital. She found temp work at legal agencies, keeping alive that distant dream of going to law school. She spent many hours at the hospital, St. Joseph's, in the cancer ward, climbing into bed with April, talking about life and its purpose and religion. April had dreamed of going on an LDS mission. Terrell had never really thought about it, but was starting to. After her diagnosis, April had gotten engaged to Neil Harris, a BYU grad who worked hard and was intensely devoted to his friends. Terrell watched how April was treated by Neil, the way he climbed into bed with his bald, bone-thin fiancé and rubbed the parts of her body that ached from chemo. Neil brushed April's teeth with the little spongy pink toothbrush that was too soft to cut into her fragile gums. It made a big impression on Terrell. "He taught me, it's okay. Not every guy is bad." The respect was mutual. To Neil, Terrell seemed so full of life, unfazed, really, even fearless. She spoke her mind. She wasn't put off by April's beauty or presence, the kind of thing that made some women uncomfortable. "She wasn't intimidated by anything," says Neil. Terrell, after much consultation with April, decided to go on an LDS mission to Costa Rica in July 1989. Her eyes were wide open with awareness. She knew she was helping fulfill April's dream, and Terrell felt she was taking a step toward making her own destiny. Yet, she also knew she was escaping. She wouldn't be there when April died, but that seemed to be okay with April, who implored Terrell to go. Terrell also knew she'd likely miss the deaths of her maternal grandparents, who'd been among the handful of people to look out for her when things were really at their worst. When she went on the mission, she recalls, "It was a realization for me that God loved me and wanted something good for me, and it was okay to have a good life and to want to help others. But it was also something of a protector for me. I had this best friend, and she was going to die. And these other people in my life I was close with, and they were going to die." All three passed away while Terrell was gone. She came home from her mission on January 2, 1991. She had enough distance now from her upbringing that she felt it wouldn't define her for the rest of her life. Maybe she could even use her upbringing to her advantage. The woman looked to be in her 30s, with dark hair and dark skin, a feral, terrified look in her dark eyes, wet with tears. No wonder. She had holes burned in her face, like someone had taken a cigarette to her. Except much worse, if it's possible to imagine. a strange pattern of dark, round burn marks all along her cheek. Terrell sat at her desk in the small offices of the Community Services Victims Advocate Program, located in the Orange County Courthouse. It was 1992, and this victim didn't want to be here. Behind sobs, she and the friend who dragged her in to see Terrell explained what had happened. The woman had four children, all under the age of 12, and a jealous, controlling husband. He didn't like her leaving the house, certainly not using the car. He didn't even like her driving to her job at Taco Bell, even on a rainy night. So sometimes, when it rained, the woman would ask for a ride home from a colleague. That's what had happened two nights earlier. She'd finished her Taco Bell shift. It was pouring. The manager offered to give her a ride home when his shift ended a half hour later. In a downpour, he dropped her off in front of her house. Her husband, angry she was late, went into a rage upon seeing another man drop her off. He ripped her hair. He tied her up. He said, "I'll make it so no man will ever want to look at you again." He held the clothes iron to the side of her face. She didn't call the police. She said she didn't want to be there talking to Terrell, dealing with it, confronting her husband. Terrell recalls the woman imploring, "I'm a religious woman, and my husband, he's an important man." She explained, "He's the bishop of the local Mormon church, an LDS lay leader. Nobody has a right to hurt you. Nobody." Terrell says she told the woman, "You deserve to live a normal life." Inside, Terrell seethed. She tried to keep her wits about her. The woman wouldn't relent. Finally, Terrell came to the rationale she felt inside so personally, so deeply. The reason that, if nothing else, was her best bet at swaying women to act. "If you don't do something, eventually your kids will be the punching bags." The woman agreed to go ahead. They served a protective order so the man couldn't go in the house, and a restraining order to keep him a safe distance away from her. Eventually, she got a divorce. It was one of the victories, weighed against plenty of losses. To Neil Harris, now one of Terrell's close friends, it was a powerful example of the leather skin underneath her bubbly exterior. "It was one of the most awful things I'd ever heard about," he says, looking back. "Not just the act, the actor. He was a Mormon bishop, an ecclesiastical leader in her faith. It didn't matter," he says. "Not that it should have. She comes in with the attitude that we are going to cut his nuts off. Basically, this isn't a time for crying. This is a time to make sure he's punished for what he did." One night a few years earlier in Norwalk, a tough Los Angeles area city checkered with locos and primos and five or six other rival, mostly Latino gangs, a high school party broke out and a fight along with it. Words were exchanged, egos bruised, reputations challenged. 17-year-old Alan Warner threw a big roundhouse. He crumpled the other boy, breaking his jaw. Alan had had his share of scuffles and could handle himself okay. He felt he had to, given the neighborhood he grew up in. But it wasn't just that. He wasn't much into toeing the line. He was drunk the night of that fight and plenty of other nights, too. He tried pretty much every drug. He never looked twice at a girl like Terrell. "She was straight-laced, and I was on the other end of the spectrum," he says. He knew her through the Cerritos Church, and he knew her family a bit. She was short and kind of attractive. "I was looking for someone who could keep up on the weekends." Before Terrell's mission, her mother suggested she go on a date with the same Alan Warner. "Remember him?" her mom had said. "He used to help us move furniture when we moved. Dad is a roofer, one of six kids. Nice Mormon family." Yeah, Terrell knew him. He was rough around the edges, a football player. The guy who'd made fun of her car in the church parking lot after she'd gotten in a fender bender. But he was going on a mission too, his to Alaska. He'd gone through a repentance process so he could cleanse himself of the behavior that would preclude him from going on a mission. While on it, he and Terrell wrote a few letters to each other. When he came home, he asked Terrell on a date. She invited him over for a home-cooked dinner. He loved it. Only later did he learn the cooking was actually done by Terrell's roommate. But he was hooked. Not on the food so much, but on this strong-willed, determined young woman. She could push him in the right direction, he thought. Plus, he wanted a family. So did Terrell. She'd reached a kind of peace about it. She could will it. She could make everything right. 2 months later, on Labor Day 1992, they were engaged. And 7.5 months later, they got married at Los Angeles' Mormon Temple, like Terrell had dreamed about as a little girl. At the wedding reception, held at the Los Coyotes Country Club, Danny showed up belligerent, but a handful of men were at the door waiting for him and turned him away. As determined as Terrell had become to not be weighed down by her childhood, Danny remained a daunting and unpredictable figure, and her brother was sliding, disappearing into the maw of addiction. Bad luck seemed to follow her, the death of April included. There had to be a way out for good. One day, not long after Terrell and Alan were married, he came home hurting after one of those long, rough days roofing. He'd thrown up over the side of one of the houses, sick. She said, "You're not going to do this anymore. You're going to go to college, and we're going to get you into another profession." They found the right college, Utah State in Logan. Alan had family in the area. Both were Mormon. It was beautiful country. Alan thought maybe he'd become an electrical engineer. Before moving, Terrell faced her biggest challenge yet, the one that most terrified her. She and Alan had a baby, a little girl, Jamie, born on September 15, 1994. That meant Terrell, the little girl from the broken home, would be the mom trying to keep the pattern from reproducing itself. She had a new husband who sometimes needed pushing. Danny was still hovering out there, and Michael, his own drug use intensifying, was becoming a bigger challenge in her life, a wild card. How could she break the cycle? She felt a little more solid on the work front. Within a few months of moving to Logan, Terrell found a job. She became the victim's advocate with Cache County in the prosecutor's office. Several years into the job, a story worked its way into the prosecutor's office about police exploring allegations that a dad from a nearby small town had raped his teen daughter. The evidence wasn't clear, in part because the mother was telling the daughter to let the thing drop, according to the county attorney at the time, Scott Wyatt. Wyatt had hired Terrell and had watched her become a tenacious victim's advocate. She took on a role, Wyatt said, that wasn't typical of victim's advocates. Terrell didn't just offer advice to the victims in going through the system. She got involved in the case and pushed investigators and prosecutors. Wyatt says she was right so often that he and others listened carefully to her. She was never overzealous, but sometimes it was like, "Oh my gosh, can you give me a break? We've got a big job to do. Can't we just move on?" In the case of the rape allegation, Wyatt says, Terrell began looking into it, almost taking on an investigator's role. Wyatt recalls she was convinced there are much bigger problems with the family. The dad got arrested and eventually convicted. The case would have been dropped without Terrell, Wyatt says, adding, Terrell was the only person who supported this girl. And there was more. Once the man was imprisoned, it came out that he'd raped his other children too. It happened again and again, Wyatt says of Terrell's involvement in cases. In another instance, a mother reported that her daughter had been sexually abused by a man in the community. The police couldn't nail it down. The prosecutor's office, following Terrell's instinct, used wiretap evidence to secure a conviction. Wyatt said Terrell also helped organize community meetings with the religious leaders, the bishops, who often were the first people contacted when a problem cropped up. Terrell was trying to take the stigma out of family abuse and show it's not, among other things, something a family can just take care of itself. Wyatt says of her, she thinks, why spend all of our time fixing problems when we can perhaps devote a little time preventing them in the first place? Here's how Terrell puts it of her hopes and passions. I'm not going to be like Aaron Brockovich, someone who is going to do amazing things, but I'm going to do something. I'm going to do something even if I'm told no. Terrell had, of course, read and heard about what happened to Keith Odell and Jim Farfaro. She wasn't sure there was anything she could do professionally, because at the time, she assumed the accident took place in Box Elder County, where Tremonton was located. In fact, however, the accident had taken place across the Cache County line, within Terrell's area of jurisdiction. Regardless, she thought she might extend herself to a fellow victim, a friend. On that night in the late fall, after their daughter's gymnastics practice, she approached Jackie and made an overture that set in motion a cascade. "I'm sorry," Terrell said to Jackie. "Is there anything I can do to help?" Part 2. Reckoning. Chapter 16. The Neuroscientists. Outside Lawrence, Kansas, two dogs and a man walk along a gravel road surrounded by open fields. The sky is vast, unblocked by buildings. Even the modest ranch-style homes are separated by many acres. Elm, ash, oak, and other trees dot the landscape in clumps. The two dogs are Lupin, a Boston Terrier, and Bebop, a tricolor Welsh Corgi. The man with their lead stuffed in the pockets of his orange fleece is Dr. Atchley, the Kansas University psychologist and introspective former Army captain turned scholar. He's thinking about the Bible. Earlier in the day, an unusually temperate February morning, one of Dr. Atchley's cognitive neuroscientist students had asked him about the scientific validity of intelligent design. That's the idea that the existence of the Earth and its people are better explained by divine inspiration than by evolution. Dr. Atchley's initial response was that intelligent design qualifies as pseudoscience. But he brought himself here, to this walk in the open in the silence, to clear his head and ponder the question. This is a big part of every day for Dr. Atchley, if not the walk, the retreat. He lives here, on 26 acres, about a 10-minute drive from campus, in an underground house that he designed a few years ago. It's around 2,600 square feet, and covered fully by hardscrabble brown dirt on one side, with nearly 8 feet of land above the structure of the roof. One side, facing south, is window-lined, inviting light and heat. His wife, Ruth Ann, is chair of the psychology department at Kansas. The Dr. Atchleys think of this place as their quiet, protective cocoon, and also part architectural novelty that they still seem bemused the bank ever let them borrow to build. Underground, inside the house, it's cool in the winter, and mostly in the summer, too. Year-round, there is no cell phone service, at least not inside. They do get internet access. Outside, owls, frogs, deer, the occasional bobcat, and Dr. Atchley keeps a small colony of bees. In the garage, he parks a Subaru with a personalized license plate. It reads, "Attend." When asked to explain, he jokes, "Because turn off your fucking cell phone is too long for a license plate." On the day of the conversation about intelligent design, Dr. Atchley walked and thought, and later that night, he crafted an email back to his student in which he quoted Hebrews 11:1. "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." And then Dr. Atchley continued his note in his own words. "If you try to play the game of using a method that relies on testing observable evidence, it seems to me you ignore the message of faith, which is that faith does not require evidence and should be strong in the face of evidence to the contrary. Reread Job for a better lesson on faith despite contrary evidence." In other words, don't expect science to prove your faith. Religion doesn't come up much for Dr. Atchley, and when it does, he can call on the years he spent at a Jesuit high school. Usually he's exploring people's dedication to a different idol, that of technology. Why are we so drawn to our devices? What makes us check them all the time, when sitting at dinner, when behind the wheel of a car? Are these devices so attractive that, despite our best intentions, we cannot help ourselves? He believes that to be true, but is not relying on his gut. He wants to prove it. Some of the questions appear to be difficult, even impossible to answer, but they might not be impossible to answer. We may not be able to point to the exact mechanism in the brain, but we can infer it with the right kinds of experiments. For Dr. Atchley, who's doing some of the foremost research in the field, the questions suggest he's awoken from his own blind faith in technology. Before there were computers in Silicon Valley, before the land gave way to industrial design, there was fruit. Oranges and pomegranates, avocados, acre after acre, trees and dust under a hot sun. Perfect farming conditions. Before Silicon Valley was Silicon Valley, it was one big farm. The Valley of the Heart's Delight. Talk about innovation. The fruit cup was invented in the Valley of the Heart's Delight by Del Monte. Then World War II came along, and the Varian brothers and Hewlett and Packard arrived. They got their early funding from the federal government, defense contractors with a high-tech bent. This intersection of computers, telecommunications, and the military would yield a change arguably as significant and characteristic of modern life as anything in medicine and the industrialization of food. It was the birth of the Internet. The product of a research program initiated in 1973 by a branch of the military called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. The aim was to create a communication system that would go across multiple networks, making it less vulnerable to attack or instability. It was, if nothing else, very hardy. Silicon Valley became an engine for its growth, serving it and feeding from it. Still, there were orchards left, a dwindling handful. Computers and communications technology commingling with open spaces. A perfect place to be a 13-year-old. Particularly one with a bike, an innate curiosity, and a latchkey. A younger Dr. Atchley, an only child with working parents, had to entertain himself. His mother, a hippie by orientation, worked as a legal secretary. His stepfather was a physicist and engineer who designed machines that made silicon wafers, which computer microprocessors are built on. Left to himself, Paul, a slight boy with dark hair, spent hours trucking through the patchwork of fields and residences. He looked for rocks to turn over and ditches to explore. I can still smell what it smelled like in those summertime, dried-up algae, frog-filled catching places, he says. He was also fascinated by computers. He vividly remembers the day he went with his dad, actually his stepfather who had legally adopted him, to the local bite shop to look at the first Apple computer. It cost more than $1,000, way beyond the pale. Paul's own at-home technology was relegated to a black-and-white television he had in his room and on which he watched local channels and monster movies. He loved fantasy and sci-fi and read books about what to do to survive a nuclear attack. He imagined he'd live in an underground house. Finally, he got a computer. It was called a TI-99, made by Texas Instruments, and it was one of the first home computers. Kids used them to play games. Paul did that. But his interest went beyond games. It wasn't that it gave me the ability to play games. It was that it gave me the ability to do anything I wanted with it. Program my own games. Use the tape drive to store secret information. What it really represented was limitless potential. At that point in my life, I was convinced I'd become a botanist on a space station. He was serious. Technology had been moving so quickly, doubling, tripling, quadrupling in power. We were expanding beyond ourselves, beyond our own planet, pushing back frontiers, bettering ourselves, and communicating across geographic barriers. From his room, he could reach out across the city, the country, the globe. He didn't realize it, but he was in the midst of an extraordinary time. One reason things were changing so much owed to a familiar technology maxim called Moore's Law. It essentially says computing power doubles every 18 months to 2 years. But there's another key technology axiom. It defines a different kind of change to the world in our lives, and indirectly would drive Paul's eventual research, Metcalfe's Law. It defines the value of a telecommunications network, say the internet, as proportional to the square of the number of users. The more people, the more valuable the network. It was named after Robert Metcalfe, an electrical engineer and innovator, who helped develop the Ethernet computing standard used to connect computers over short distances. According to a history published by Princeton University, Metcalfe's law was officially christened in 1993, but the principle was first identified in 1980 when Paul was getting his TI-99 and dividing time between it and his bike. It's not that the concepts eloquently captured by Metcalfe's law were entirely new. Networks had been developing, and their potential significance were defined in the latter half of the century. But Metcalfe put a fine point on what had become a core attribute of media by the end of the 20th century. One simple way to think about how much had changed, how much power had come to personal communications, is illustrated by a simple comparison. In World War II, an extraordinary calculating machine commissioned by the U.S. military, the Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer, could, each second, perform around 350 multiplications or 5,000 simple additions. By 2012, the iPhone 4 made by Apple could do 2 billion instructions per second. The iPhone 5 in 2013, even more. The ENIAC weighed 30 tons. The iPhone 5 was less than 4 ounces. It carries voice communications and the internet, a crystallization of all the wondrous powers of the previous millennia, a machine in our pockets that, on its face, worked fully in people's service, the ultimate entertainment and productivity machine. By the standard of the iPhone, when Dr. Atchley was just teenage Paul, the pace of their communications and the amount of variety of information, print, voice, video, was relatively limited. Maybe not by phone, but certainly by computer or mobile phone. As Paul was growing up, a half-generation before Reggie came of age, there was a coming together of these two fundamental computing principles, Moore's Law and Metcalfe's Law. One defined the acceleration of computer processing power, which allowed not just speed, but so many capabilities, including at its core, interactivity. The other captured the rapid expansion of the communications network and its value. In union, they were combining to provide unprecedented service to humans. But they were also putting a new kind of pressure on the human brain. Moore bringing increased information ever faster, and Metcalfe making the information so personal as to make the gadgets extraordinarily seductive, even addictive. A few months before Dr. Atchley took his February morning walk with his dogs, he attended a first-of-its-kind conference in Southern California. About 200 neuroscientists gathered with support from the National Academy of Sciences to confront a new question. What is technology doing to our brains? The introductory lecture was given by Clifford Nass, the provocative Stanford University sociologist, who, 2 years earlier, had gotten Dr. Strayer and Dr. Ghazali together to think about the science of multitasking. Now, Dr. Nass was pushing scientists to go beyond the existing science and ask hard questions about whether the ubiquity of constantly connected mobile devices could, ultimately, hamper the things that make us most human. Empathy, conflict resolution, deep thinking, and, in a way, progress itself. Near the front sat Dr. Ghazali, mentally preparing for his own talk to be given shortly. Seated in the upper right, Dr. Strayer wore glasses, his neck slightly hunched. And in the back row, Dr. Atchley. His wire-rimmed glasses were perched on his nose, and his Macintosh laptop was shut beneath him. That was somewhat noteworthy. Many in the crowd had laptops open, including a guy just in front of Dr. Atchley, who had four windows open, checking email, the news, and a shopping site. In explaining why he doesn't open his laptop, Dr. Atchley calls upon a phrase from his Jesuit training. "Lead me not into temptation, but deliver me from evil," he says, paraphrasing Matthew 6:13. He thinks that if he opens his laptop, he'll start checking things, get distracted from the lecture and his own analysis of it. He doesn't trust himself to be disciplined, and he says some fundamental neuroscience has emerged to support his fears. There's plenty of anecdotal evidence, too. At the University of Kansas, the journalism school does a periodic media fast in which students aren't allowed to use their devices for 24 hours. When the fast took place in the fall of 2011, students reflected afterward about their experience. To wit, how could I abandon my closest friend, my iPhone? My media fast lasted 15 minutes before I forgot that I was fasting and checked my phone. The withdrawals were too much for me to handle. 5 minutes without checking a text message is like the end of the world. I don't want to do this assignment again. Why? Why is this stuff so compelling? Dr. Atchley says one thing that makes the question fascinating to him is that when people multitask, they often do so in situations that defy common sense, say, trying to concentrate on an in-person conversation while checking a sports score or attempting to drive while dialing a phone. He believes that there are impulses driving these multitaskers that don't meet the eye. In fact, he says technology increasingly is appealing to and preying upon deep, primitive instincts. Parts of us that existed eons before the phone. For one, the power of social connection. The need to stay in touch with friends, family, and business connections. Simple, irresistible. It's a brain hijack machine, he says. He's trying to prove it. A trip to his lab, he says, will help illustrate what he means. Chapter 17. Terrell. Toward the end of 2006, when Terrell first approached Jackie outside of gymnastics and asked how she might help, Jackie showed typical stoicism and said, "I think we're good." Terrell, respecting Jackie's strength and privacy, let it go. Besides, she still thought the accident had happened in the adjoining county, Box Elder. So, she settled in for being a friend. Just before Christmas that year, the Ferfaros and the Warners went to a gymnastics meet in Park City. Jackie piled the girls into the Saturn. Terrell and Alan drove their van, carrying the brood of four. Jamie, the oldest, then 12 years old, Taylor, the boy, age 10 at the time, Alyssa, just shy of 5 years old, and Katie, who was 3 and suffered from cystic fibrosis and autism. At the meet and over meals, talk between the Warners and the Ferfaros was about the kids and gymnastics, not the accident. A few days later, Jackie took Stephanie and Cassidy to her mother's house in Nevada for the Christmas holiday. That meant driving on Valley View Drive. As she packed the girls into the Saturn, she tried to avoid the thought that within 10 minutes, she'd be at the spot where Jim had died. She put on the radio, and for the girls, started a Disney movie, which showed on monitors that attached to the back of the front seats, absorbing Stephanie and Cassidy. The aftermarket DVD player had initially been a sore spot between her and Jim. "Why did they need this?" Jim had asked. She told him sternly, "You're not always with us on the drive. You don't know how hard it is to go 6 hours without entertainment." Altogether, they were at least a 9-screen household at the time of Jim's death. There were the computers downstairs, and a third on the dining room table that the girls sometimes used. The movie screens in the back seat of her Saturn. Each parent had phones. There were 2 televisions. Not included are the various GPS and other devices Jim played around with. Soon after the accident, Stephanie, the older of the girls, had begun to play World of Warcraft, using her father's account and his computer and desk, peering into his hefty NEC monitor. Jim and Jackie had decided that she could use World of Warcraft when she turned 6. After Jim's death, Jackie and the girls also got lost in films, holding movie nights. In particular, they'd gather around and watch The Sound of Music, or another classic, and eat a takeout pizza. For a while, Stephanie suspended her playing of Dance Dance Revolution because it reminded her of her father. A few days after Jim died at the viewing of the body, Jackie had asked the girls to look at their father so they could know and understand that this was a real thing. As Stephanie would later recall in a school essay, her mother came up to her afterward and said, "I'm so sorry this happened, and I know you can be strong and get through it." Media seemed to help. As Jackie drove that morning on their Christmas journey, the girls watching Disney, she tried to lose herself in the radio. She thought, if I get teary, my vision gets bleary, and then it'll be hard to drive, and then I'll have to explain to the kids why I'm stopping. For Christmas that year, she felt she overdid it a bit with the presents. I got the girls too many books. For Christmas, Jackie was in Nevada, Leila was at home, Terrell was in Mexico, at an orphanage. On that Sunday before Christmas, Terrell and Alan surprised the family with the trip to Mexico. But it wasn't exactly a vacation, Terrell told the kids. She brought out a bunch of seemingly random supplies, toothbrushes, combs, little deodorant sticks. They were the makings of hygiene kits to be handed out along with puzzles, books, and sun hats at an orphanage in Puerto Penasco. The next day, they piled back into the Ford Windstar van and drove south, stopping for the night in Searchlight, Nevada. Puerto Penasco is about 100 miles south of the Arizona border on a strip of land that connects the Baja Peninsula to the rest of Mexico. The Warners stayed free in a condo that belonged to Neil Harris, Terrell's old friend from Southern California, who had been engaged to April before she died of cancer. Neil had hit it big in the technology field. Really big. He held top sales jobs at 4 different technology companies that were ultimately sold or went public for more than $1 billion each. There was Synoptics Communications, which was among the pioneers in creating technology to allow for faster, more efficient delivery of data over Ethernet lines. It merged in 1994 with another company in a $2.4 billion deal, a precursor to the dot-com boom. Neil moved to Ascend Communications, which built little boxes to terminate internet signals and was acquired by Lucent Technologies in 1999 for $24 billion, one of the largest acquisitions in history. And after that, Neil went to Foundry Networks, which made routers and switches, essential pieces of technology to deliver internet traffic. It would be acquired by Brocade for $3 billion in July 2008. He was, like so many fortunate Americans, a big beneficiary of Metcalfe's Law. More connections, faster connections, more efficient connections. Neil and others in the booming tech industry, serving a seemingly insatiable drive to communicate with one another and trade at ever-increasing rates. They were creating the most powerful robots and conduits the world had ever seen. Things that each year were making the tools of the previous year seem slow by comparison. They were creating wealth. This was another side of the technology revolution. Big, big money. Neil had amassed a multi-million-dollar fortune. Among the benefits of his wealth, he purchased 2 3-bedroom condominiums in Puerto Penasco. Terrell said she wanted to take the children there for Christmas to work at the orphanage, to teach them to give back. My kids need to see there are people who have less than them, she says. They need to learn empathy at a young age. On the outside, the Warners seemed like they'd developed into a perfect family. The children were excelling in school. They attended church. Neil looked at Terrell with some wonder, given her childhood. How could she turn out so different, given her upbringing? Would it come back to haunt her? It's a question I end up asking myself quite often, he says. Think about all the things she had going against her. It helped that the Warners had moved to Utah, but not completely. There were parts of Terrell's journey the decade prior to the crash that showed how haunted she remained by her youth. In the fall of 1998, 8 years before Reggie hit the rocket scientists, Terrell stood in a Mervyn's at a mall in Orem, Utah, about 45 miles south of Salt Lake City, not far from Provo. She was glancing at the women's clothes, passing time. She and Alan had driven down to visit his family. They'd, of course, brought with them Jamie, their firstborn, and Taylor, their newest addition to the family who had been born 2 years earlier on October 18, 1996. As Terrell was glancing at the dresses in Mervyn's, she suddenly realized that Taylor had disappeared. Taylor? No response. She was searching frantically. Taylor! No response. Alan! Alan! Her boy was missing. It felt just like Danny had snatched Mitchell, just like in her nightmares. Was Danny there? Alan ran over. "What's going on?" Terrell was in a full-blown panic. And then Taylor appeared. Her little guy peeked out from between two dresses in a circular rack. She scooped him up. She was beyond crying, nearly hysterical, which was not at all Terrell's style. "We're going home. We're going home." They never made it to the family gathering. It was, Terrell said, PTSD. Danny had taken Mitchell from her. She had willed herself away from that place. She'd moved far away. But she learned the limits of geographic distance. She carried with her the ghosts of Danny's abuse. They'd moved to Logan 3 years before that Mervyn's incident, in 1995. Alan attended Utah State. After living in a condo, they'd found a house for sale in 1997 for $94,000. It was that cheap because it was infested with hornets, had no toilets, and was ill-configured. Of the 3,000 square feet of livable space, fully half of it was the living room. Weirdly, the house's lack of perfection appealed to Terrell. It let her feel like she was distancing herself from her mother, who Terrell always felt put on airs that everything was okay, even though it was a big fat lie. She decided to take a deliberately different approach. "I don't care if the house is perfect all the time." That would be superficial, she thought. It didn't mean she wanted a hornet-infested mess. They fixed it up, made it livable, just another long-term improvement project for Terrell. She was taking these steps, making declarations, trying to rebuild herself, just as she was remaking the house with the hornets' nests the size of basketballs. During this period, she had another key rebuilding project on her hands. She was getting to know her real father. That whole thing unfolded a few years earlier, when Jamie was 8 months old and the family still lived in Southern California. Terrell and the baby were walking in a mall in Palm Springs with Kathy. A woman came up to Terrell's mom and said, "Are you Kathy Hartman?" The woman was from Kathy's high school days. The woman asked Kathy how Woody was doing and whether Woody still worked at Kodak. In an instant, it all came together for Terrell. Someone named Woody had been her actual father, and Michael's father, too. She'd never known her dad's name. Now she did. At the urging of her friend Neil, Terrell contacted the Department of Motor Vehicles and managed to find this guy named Woody Hartman. She made contact with him, and he told her that Kathy had told him that she was happy and had started another family. He says Kathy urged him to let her and the children move on with their lives, explaining his eventual absence, something he says he regrets. Sometimes, early on, Woody would call to see how the children were doing. When Terrell learned this, she thought she'd solved one of the mysteries of her childhood. Why she was told not to answer the phone. "My dad would call, and she didn't want me to pick up." Terrell would occasionally burst into fury. "It breaks my heart," she says. "I had no father at graduations, milestones, my wedding. I lost out on a whole relationship in high school, middle school, college without a father." The years she lost with her father had Terrell thinking about being a victim from a different perspective. She developed a particular empathy for people who lost their moms or dads. The more she learned about the accident on Valley View Drive on September 22, 2006, the more Terrell thought about the other victims, not just Jackie. There was Leila, and this 18-year-old girl Megan, who was growing up without her dad. On January 2, 2006, Megan married her fiancé, Thomas Dunn. The ceremony took place at a small LDS church near the main downtown area. The bride wore a white gown with a top that bunched up around the middle. She walked down the aisle by herself, not wanting anyone to replace her dad. She finally felt the weight of his absence, after keeping it at a numb distance for many months. "I couldn't stand the idea that my dad wasn't really there. I just didn't want to believe he was gone," she says of those months of denial. At the wedding, on a brown upright piano in the church, she'd put a big picture of her dad. Her mother, she says, was crying hysterically. It was like my dad's funeral all over again. The marriage didn't work. Megan had been struggling for a few years with school grades and swimming injuries, with her relationship with her parents. She hadn't gotten a job, and that was one of several sources of growing tension with her new husband. They fought. Really fought. Not a month after the marriage, the cops were called in after she and her husband got into a physical altercation. Megan was arrested. She got probation. A first offender break. Her life was getting away from her. She spent hours a day, sometimes all day, playing shooting games on the Xbox, either against her husband or teaming up with him against other people they'd meet online. They'd fight with myriad virtual heavy weaponry across elaborate virtual terrain, seeing which team could get 50 kills first. She felt good when she was online, like she was skilled, and it was thrilling, the constant, intense interactivity. "I don't know how to explain it," she says of her passion for playing. "It's pretty much all we ever did." At the start of 2007, Megan and Leila were struggling to find anything close to closure around Keith's death. Jackie, with raw determination, was doing a bit better. Terrell remained at arm's length, but not for long. And Trooper Renlisbacher was about to get a break. Chapter 18. Hunt for Justice. On January 8, 2007, 3.5 months after Reggie hit the Saturn and killed the rocket scientists, Trooper Rendlesbacher's tenacity paid off. He got the okay to go after Reggie's cell phone records. It came in the form of an application to conduct a criminal investigation. It had been put together by Tony C. Baird, one of the county prosecutors. On page 12 of the 14-page application, the document states that, just following the accident, Trooper Rendlesbacher drove Reggie to the hospital and observed Shaw using his phone to receive and send text messages. The phone did not make any audible noise, but on several occasions, Shaw pulled the phone from his coat pocket and sent a text message. Shaw held the phone with his right hand and used his right thumb to type and send each message. A page later, it says that Trooper Rendlesbacher asked Reggie whether he'd been texting during the accident. He denied using it. Shaw could not or would not give a reasonable explanation for his driving pattern. But if it sounded like the district attorney's office was circling Reggie, that was far from the case. Baird, the prosecutor, had his skepticism about what the facts would show and whether there was applicable law. For now, the document was a permission slip to Trooper Rendlesbacher. And the real meat of the document lay in its middle, pages 6 and 7. It was a subpoena, aimed at Verizon Wireless. The company was ordered to provide to the trooper, as an official of the state, records associated with Reggie's number. Copies of billing statements from September of 2006 until present. These copies should include both incoming and outgoing tolls of both calls and text messages. This should include all incoming and outgoing phone numbers dialed or received. In the middle of January, Leila got a call from Herm Olson, the lawyer. There were two things on his mind. He'd been thinking about the accident and about the scene where it happened. "There's no shoulder on the road," he said. "The road isn't safe. Everybody knows it's not safe." Leila thought back to what she'd seen at the accident site. On either side of the highway were about 4 inches of pavement, then a sharp drop into the gully. Olson told Leila that it might be worth getting an engineer. He told her that, depending on what the engineer found, it could be worth suing the state. "I don't care about that. I want the road fixed," Leila told Olson. "Please, just get them to get the road fixed." Olson took it in. He had one more thing to bring up with Leila. Had she heard what happened with the investigation? Was it over? Did Reggie get a ticket? Olson told Leila the police should have alerted her, but she told him that they hadn't. She resolved to find out. She hung up with him and placed a call to the county clerk's office. They hadn't heard a thing about it. She dug up the business card of one of the officers who had visited her after the accident. Shortly thereafter, the phone rang. She sat down at the counter in her kitchen and picked up. "This is Bart Rendlesbacher," the man said. He explained that he'd been looking into what happened at the accident. Then he went into a story about how he watched Reggie texting on the way to the hospital. What? Leila was shocked. This is so different from what I've been told. The trooper told her that, despite getting permission to investigate, he was having trouble getting the cell phone records. In fact, the Shaw family wouldn't confirm which carrier was Reggie's, and the investigator was going company to company trying to figure out where to start. Leila had the impression that the trooper was open and honest, but also dogged. I really had the impression he was doing a great deal of this on his own. She hung up and felt like she needed to do something too. Texting and driving. Could it really have happened? It seemed to her so absolutely absurd, so illogical, so dangerous. She thought back to Herm Olson's firm. The first principal, Lyle Hilliard, was a state senator. A seed was planted in the back of her mind, something tiny and still unrecognizable to her. Yet it would blossom. Leila would eventually need to do something positive with her grief. Maybe the senator could help. Chapter 19. Reggie.
Matchup zone! Matchup zone!
Reggie, in a shirt and tie, standing next to a metal folding chair, shouted defensive instructions to five scrawny-armed sophomores of the Bear River Bears, Reggie's former high school team. It was winter 2007, during a basketball game against the Grizzlies from Logan High School. It looked to be trouble. Earlier in the season, the Grizzlies had crushed the Bears, but things were tighter this game. Reggie was feeling the tension, getting lost in it. Toward the end of the year, before Thanksgiving, he'd taken up an offer from Van Park, the varsity coach, to help coach the sophomores. Reggie was the assistant coach to Greg Madsen, who doubled as coach and the publisher of The Leader, the Tremonton newspaper. Madsen couldn't make this game, so Reggie was on his own. An adage in sports is that defense wins championships. It fit into Reggie's own personality on the court. Hustle. Do the unheralded jobs. Let your teammates score. He was trying to impress this on the sophomores, and in this game, that meant constantly changing the defense to keep the other team off guard. Man-to-man and zone, 1-2-2, 1-3-1. Every other time down the court, we were in something different, Reggie says. It was just constant. Bear River lost by 6. He was initially disappointed, then felt some measure of moral victory, having kept it so close against the bigger school. Basketball brought momentary relief. In all honesty, the basketball was such a great release, an avenue for him to get lost, says Madsen. He knew Reggie well, as a player and as a kid. Nearly in his 50s, Madsen was in Reggie's church ward and had been an assistant to Van Park on Reggie's own varsity high school teams. In the 2006-2007 season, just after the accident, Madsen felt like Reggie mostly didn't portray the grief he felt. But then he'd see Reggie in a quiet moment, and he'd see a momentarily blank stare. Madsen felt like Reggie was flashing back to the accident, but he didn't feel it was his place to pry. You could tell it was eating him up. Madsen decided a good therapy might be to give Reggie more responsibility. And so the coach allowed Reggie more latitude to coach on his own, say to take the guards for parts of practice or the big men, responsibilities that he might not otherwise give to a first-timer. When he spoke, they listened, and not just in the way that younger kids in that community did when coaches talked. He'd had some real-world experiences. He'd been through some really tough stuff. Reggie was dating again, his interest in women, if not at its full measure, returning. Her name was Trisha Haber. She was a year younger than Reggie, and a good friend of Brianna Bishop, the woman who Reggie had been seeing at the time of the wreck. Our relationship wasn't the best before the accident, and after it was kind of too much, and it didn't work out, Reggie says of dating Brianna. Brianna was from Kaysville, about 45 minutes away. Reggie had met her through Dallas, his gregarious buddy. Trisha was one of the girls in the group they hung out with. She had curly hair and a dark tint to her skin, her dad being from Israel. Trisha worked in a T-Mobile store. She and Reggie went on dates, taking turns making the 45-minute drive. She knew about the accident, seemed supportive, though they didn't talk much about it. They did discuss a future. Marriage talk, not sex talk. They made out a couple of times. That was it. Reggie had learned his lesson, and he had a focused, overriding goal. He still would go on a mission. It's what I wanted more than anything. Maybe he'd be able to go in June. Just pick up where he'd left off. This is how it went in the spring of 2007. A kind of collective life as it used to be, with an unspoken terror it could all burst apart. Leila Odell and her daughter, Jackie Farfaro and her daughters, and Reggie and his family began trying to reclaim their lives. There were fits and starts of normality, but always a specter loomed. Somewhere, out there, some machinery, embodied by the stubborn trooper Renlisbacher, was following a trail. Occasionally the Shaws would check in with John Bunderson. He had a stock cliché, no news is good news. And for his part, he wasn't about to contact Cache County officials. Don't kick a sleeping dog, he described as his philosophy. He fielded some questions about insurance from the Shaws and the insurance companies. On the criminal front, there was a sense in Reggie's camp that maybe it would all go away. Far from it. With the legal force of the Cache County Attorney's Office, Renlisbacher had been faxing Verizon in late January and early February. The fax asked for phone records associated with Reggie's number, and the document included a copy of obituaries for Keith and Jim published in the Herald Journal, Logan's local newspaper, on September 25th, 3 days after the accident. It took at least 5 requests to get the records, and then the trouble was, the information didn't make sense. Renlisbacher needed reinforcements. A meeting took place in the Highway Patrol office in Cache County, the same second-floor office where Renlisbacher had come immediately after the accident. Sergeant Tony Hudson, who'd been working with him on the case, was there, along with a new guy, Scott Singleton. It was March 15th, a Thursday, at 10:30 in the morning. Scott was the new local agent for the Utah State Bureau of Investigation, assigned to the northernmost counties. Scott didn't much like his job's chief responsibility, hang out at bars and, as Singleton put it, enforce Utah's crazy alcohol laws. A Byzantine labyrinth of rules and regulations, he said, that he was supposed to enforce sitting at a bar all night long, which I hated. When he had time, though, there was a part of the job he loved. He was supposed to help pursue cases for the highway patrol that were taking a lot of time, that the individual troopers didn't have resources to pursue. Not cold cases exactly, but complex ones. The job suited Singleton after a long period wandering. Born in 1964 in the tiny farm town of Benjamin, Utah, the son of a plumber, Singleton was a nice kid, but a poor student, shy, a follower, a practical joker. At Spanish Fork High School, where his grade point average didn't reach past 3.0, he was a reasonable class clown. Once, when the National Guard came out to celebrate the school's newly renovated football field, Scott joined a few friends hoisting signs that read, "Make football fields, not war." He kicked around at college, or rather, colleges. Southern Utah University, Utah Technical College, Weber State, Utah Valley. He didn't last more than a few semesters at any of these schools, finding himself driving with regularity to Arizona, where the booze laws were looser, partying regularly. In the back of his mind, he started to wonder if he had a learning disability. "I cannot pay attention for more than a few seconds," he says. "I'd sit in class, and no matter how hard I'd concentrate, if there's a window, I don't care where it is, I'm staring out of it. I'd have the hardest time paying attention." He didn't get a degree, bouncing around jobs, farming, drywalling, got married at 21, and took a job 2 years later working at the Utah Port of Entry in Wendover, an entry-level law enforcement gig. He worked his way into a job as a road trooper, then a state investigator. At the meeting that morning, Renlisbacher handed Singleton 2 cases. They were Renlisbacher specials, meaning cases that he'd gotten personally invested in. One involved a guy who randomly approached Rendlesbacher at a restaurant and offered to buy the trooper dinner. The guy was dressed as Santa Claus and struck Rendlesbacher as creepy, Singleton recalls. Then later, the same guy had been stopped while driving a taxi with a little boy in the back. Rendlesbacher did some checking and discovered the guy had pled guilty in Washington State to immoral communication with a minor. Rendlesbacher wanted to see if we could get him registered as a sex offender in Utah, Singleton explains. Rendlesbacher handed Singleton the other file, Reggie's. He told the story to Singleton, who was taken aback. I didn't have a cell phone. I never texted. He might as well have been talking about nuclear physics. In the file were several compact discs. Rendlesbacher handed them to Singleton and said, I think we've got proof. The discs contain records from Verizon Wireless, the results of the subpoena. They were not on their face especially helpful. 2 days later, Singleton sat down in a windowless room in Brigham City, his immodest investigator surroundings, put one of the discs into the computer, and discovered what looked like nonsense. It was an endless list of calls and texts, intermingled, not organized by day or time, not organized in any fashion at all, and spanning a period of months. It was just jumbled, Singleton recalls. He started trying to separate the calls from the texts, the long ones from the short ones, then began organizing the data by date. It took a few weeks, working on and off, in between patrolling the bars. He didn't have much contact with Rendlesbacher. There wasn't much to say. Then, in mid-March, the data started to crystallize. Singleton was back at the computer when something stood out. 6:47. There was a text at 6:47 a.m. on September 22, 2006, the morning of the accident. Wasn't that the moment of the accident? Singleton went back and looked at the crash report. He looked for Kaiserman's 911 call. When did that happen? 6:48. And it was only moments later that Rendlesbacher, riding in the Crown Vic, had heard the call. Singleton shifted in his seat, cocked his head, tried to make sense of it. Holy cow, he muttered. He played with the number some more, looked at the order of events, text,